animal welfare can flow only from a Christian life, and that a Christian life can be promoted in the community only by an authoritarian state, which has swept away the last vestiges of the hated liberal infection. He thinks fascism not so much an evil as a good thing perverted, regards democracy as a monster whose victory would be a defeat for Christianity, and is tempted to accept even fascist assistance, hoping that he and his friends will prove the leaven in a lump of British fascists. Strativus is equally devout and equally Christian, deeply conscious of the fall, and therefore convinced that no human creature can be trusted with more than the minimum power over his fellows, and anxious to preserve the claims of God from any infringement by those of Caesar, he still sees in democracy the only hope of Christian freedom. He is tempted to accept aid from champions of the status quo, whose commercial or imperial motives bear hardly even a veneer of theism. Finally, we have Spartacus, also a Christian and also sincere, full of the prophetic and dominical denunciations of riches, and certain that the historical Jesus, long betrayed by the apostles, the fathers, and the churches, demands of us a left revolution. And he is also tempted to accept help from unbelievers who profess themselves quite openly to be the enemies of God. The three types represented by these three Christians presumably come together to form a Christian party. Either a deadlock ensues, and there the history of the Christian party ends, or else one of the three succeeds in floating a party and driving the other two, with their followers, out of its ranks. The new party, being probably a minority of the Christians, who are themselves a minority of the citizens, will be too small to be effective. In practice, it will have to attach itself to the un-Christian party nearest to it in beliefs about means. To the fascists, if Phylarchus has won, to the conservatives, if Stativus, to the communists, if Spartacus. It remains to ask how the resulting situation will differ from that in which Christians find themselves today. Is it not reasonable to suppose that such a Christian party will acquire new powers of leavening the infidel organization to which it is attached? Why should it? Whatever it calls itself, it will represent not Christendom, but a part of Christendom. The principle which divides it from its brethren and unites it to its political allies will not be theological. It will have no authority to speak for Christianity. It will have no more power than the political skill its members give it to control the behavior of its unbelieving allies. But there will be a real and most disastrous novelty. It will be not simply a part of Christendom, but a part claiming to be the whole. By the mere act of calling itself the Christian Party, it implicitly accuses all Christians who do not join it of apostasy and betrayal. It will be exposed, in an aggravated degree, to that temptation which the devil spares none of us at any time, the temptation of claiming for our favourite opinions that kind of degree of certainty and authority which really belongs only to our faith. The danger of mistaking our merely natural, though perhaps legitimate, enthusiasms for holy zeal is always great. Can any more fatal expedient be devised for increasing it than that of dubbing a small band of fascists, communists, or Democrats, the Christian party? The demon inherent in every party is at all times ready enough to disguise himself as the Holy Ghost. The formation of a Christian party means handing over to him the most efficient make-up we can find. And when once the disguise has succeeded, his commands will presently be taken to abrogate all moral laws and to justify whatever the unbelieving allies of the Christian party wish to do. If ever Christian men can be brought to think treachery and murder the lawful means of establishing the regime they desire, and fake